Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 340. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowissogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have an incredible show for you this week with two amazing guests. Let's get started with the first one. Richard Carlbaum is a political and community organizer, a fundraiser, and an exceptional advisor to political leaders at all levels of government. Most recently, he served as the campaign manager of Minnesotans United for All Families, the official Vote No campaign that helped Minnesota become the first state in the nation to defeat a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage. Richard then led Minnesotans United to successfully secure the freedom to marry for all committed couples in Minnesota in 2013, making Minnesota the first state in the Midwest to secure marriage equality through the state legislature. Before joining Minnesotans United for All Families, Richard was communications director for Chris Coleman, the mayor of St. Paul. He also managed the successful 2010 re-election campaign of Representative Tim Walz. And Richard was the youngest mayor ever elected in Minnesota at age 23. He served as the mayor of St. Joseph, Minnesota from 2005 to 2007. He was previously named by the Advocate magazine to their 40 under 40 list. Yet another example that change is connected to passion, drive, and expertise, not just age. And now he is here to share his lessons with us. Richard, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Well, thank you so much for that great introduction. I'm happy to be here.
And I had to leave stuff out, Richard, or we would have no time to chat. We have a lot of ground to cover, my friend. Are you ready?
Absolutely. Let's go.
It strikes me that you are uniquely positioned to sell our listening audience on the great state of Minnesota. On behalf of the Minnesotan Tourism Board, sell us all on the greatness of Minnesota.
Absolutely. You know, we are in the dead of winter. We just came off a week where it was the high was something like -6 on Sunday. But you know what? Minnesota does cold well. We own the cold.
Nice.
And so in Minnesota, we do things like ice fish, snowshoeing, cross-country skiing, and all kinds of weather. No matter how cold it gets, we know as long as you dress in layers, you can be active and exercise outside as much as you want, as long as it's for short periods of time.
Okay. I have used ice fishing previously as a metaphor. It strikes me you really mean it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
It's cold here right now, but the summer months are, you can't visit a better place during the summer months in Minnesota, whether you go to one of our 10,000 lakes or you just hang out by a bonfire in the evening. The weather in Minnesota year-round. We have four distinct seasons, and I think Minnesotans enjoy each and every one of them.
I could be wrong about this, but it feels like you're sold on Minnesota.
Absolutely. Born and raised in Minnesota, and you know, one of the great things, working in politics, I get to know people all over the country, and I see Minnesotans, people from Minnesota, go all over the country to do great and amazing work. And one of the things that is true about Minnesota is people never hesitate. When they get an opportunity to come back home and continue to do great work in the space that they have passion in, they inevitably choose to come back home to Minnesota. That's one of the great things about our state. Our talent may go elsewhere and help change the world, but inevitably, if they have a chance to come back, they come home.
All right. I want to visit. Now I want to come over to Minnesota.
There's something special here, that's for sure.
All right. Well, let's go back a little bit. Let's talk about little Richard Carlbaum. Did he want to be the youngest mayor? Did he have political aspirations growing up?
No, I wanted to be a radio host, or I wanted to be a TV news anchor. I wanted to be in the communication space. That's where I always thought I would end up. And it wasn't until I got to college where that all changed. I had an experience to work for a member of the state legislature here in Minnesota, and I was in charge of their constituent services work as an intern for the office. And in one day, I saw firsthand how much of an impact you can have on other people's lives when you're working in this space. It captured my imagination, and I wanted to do this work ever since.
I want to talk about that historic mayoral election in 2005 when you decided at some point, you know what, I'm throwing my hat in the ring here. What prompted you to go that route?
You know, actually, the current mayor of St. Joseph at the time was a very close friend of mine, and he and I had been talking for a long time about what he would do after being mayor of St. Joseph, and an opportunity came about where he decided to run for the State House of Representatives. And in exchange or in a commitment to doing so, as I was imploring him to commit to running for the State House of Representatives, he said to me, well, then you should run for mayor of St. Joe. And after a lot of thinking and deliberation and talking to different people, I decided to do it. And honestly, it was an old-fashioned campaign. It was a matter of introducing myself to as many people in the community, making sure that they understood that although I was young, my interest was sincere and that I wanted to do what I could to improve lives in St. Joe. And ultimately, I ended up winning. I ended up winning re-election, which I think shows that my first full term was rather smooth. We had some really hard decisions to make. But at the end of the day, I think people respected that I was doing my best to make the right decisions for the community.
Please say there were lawn signs.
Oh, there are lawn signs, and there are horrible lawn signs.
Come on.
Yeah, this is a lesson I learned. I used a local printer who I had no familiarity with. I could have used a union printer, but I chose not to. And unfortunately, I got my lawn signs in the mail, and my entire name was in the top third of the sign with the disclaimer covering the bottom half. So it was the most peculiar lawn sign you'll ever see in your life, and you know, I think there's one that exists, and that will not see the day of light as long as I can.
I have never been on such a quest as I am right now to get one of those lawn signs in my hand. So that challenge issued, challenge accepted, Richard. Now, when I ran for public office, I was 33, and I remember getting crap left, right, up, and down about my age. You were significantly younger than 33. I would imagine that that was very much a topic of conversation.
Absolutely. You know, I ran in a town that had a sizable college population. So St. Joseph at the time was a town of about 5,500, and it had about 2,000 college students in town. And so there was a great concern among, you know, lifelong residents of St. Joseph that the student vote would just kind of swamp out the city residents, the people who live there, you know, for decades, and their voices would then be kind of set aside. And one of the things I did to try and address those fear of my age and those concerned about my age was to, you know, really develop deep relationships with people who I was already familiar with, who'd lived in the city for decades. And so I, you know, did my best to make sure that people who are well respected in the community validated the fact that I was doing it for all the right reasons and in an effort to try and address those fears head on.
Nice. Tell me one thing that you are most proud of from your mayoral time.
Oh, that's easy, actually. You know, when I was mayor of St. Joseph, we are part of a very much larger school district in central Minnesota. The St. Cloud area school district encompasses essentially four or five different communities, and St. Joseph is one of the smallest among those. Yet we were able to actually launch a campaign district-wide and convince voters to spend enough money to build a brand new K-8, incredibly environmentally friendly new elementary and middle school building in the city of St. Joseph so that our residents would go to school through fourth grade and then go off to the big city for junior high and high school. And one of the things we accomplished was building a school, community school, community-based school that was K-8. And it's something that I think the community continues to be very proud of. It's one of the most energy-efficient schools in the state, even, you know, some 8 years after it was built. And it's just a wonderful thing that I will always be proud of when it comes to my time in St. Joe.
Amazing. Well, let's talk all about Minnesotans United for All Families. Before we even talk about the specifics, just generally, as you reflect back on all of the campaigns that you were a part of there, how do you wrap your mind around that whole experience?
Oh, boy. I think I look back on that time in my life, and it's amazing to me because it seems like it's 10 years ago, but it's just a few years ago.
Yeah.
And the country was in a completely different space in September 2011 when I first was named the campaign manager for that effort. And where the country was at, you know, and the day after election day, November 7th, 2012, and then 6 months later when we passed marriage in Minnesota, to see the country move so quickly in the span of, you know, what, 12 to 13 months is something that I will never certainly experience in my life. But to see the state of Minnesota, the place you call home, the place that is so personal to you, go through that transformational change in such a fast period is something that I'll always cherish and something I'll be always obviously be very proud to have been a part of.
Let me hit some highlights there. 40,000 individual volunteers, more than 80,000 individual donors contributing more than $13 million, and a network of more than 700 coalition members representing all walks of life in Minnesota. What is step one to starting those efforts? Where do we even start when we're trying to put these folks together?
Well, step one is being in a situation where you know, the LGBT community is thrust into a conversation that they didn't want to have. Nationally, the organizations didn't want to have yet one more defensive battle, especially in an election cycle where we're looking at going on the offensive in places like Washington and Maine and Maryland. And so having to fight one more defensive battle, and we've always lost these defensive battles, was a really hard position to be in. And as a lifelong Minnesotan, when this was put on the ballot, it felt like a kick in the gut. As somebody who identified as gay, who worked in politics, I couldn't believe that I was looking in the faces of people who thought that I shouldn't be simply treated as another, as any other Minnesotan, that I had to be singled out and told that who I was wasn't quite up to snuff for what the standard in Minnesota should be. And that was such a hard thing for me personally to hear. And so while I had this, you know, this desire to react with anger and lash out at people about what they were doing in my home state, one of the things we very quickly wrapped our minds around was we couldn't be a campaign based on anger and frustration and retaliation. We had to be a campaign that actually brought Minnesota together. We actually had to be a campaign that said to Minnesotans, it's okay if you're not quite supportive of gay marriage or same-sex marriage. It's okay if you're not there yet, but we want to have a conversation nonetheless. And one of the things one of our great Sons of Minnesota says, Garrison Keeler, who is just a wonderful public radio personality, one of the things he says is an extroverted Minnesotan is a Lutheran who looks at somebody else's shoes and not their own.
Yeah.
And in Minnesota, we had this challenge from the very beginning that we had to try and spark conversations where people felt like they could be a little bit vulnerable. They're welcomed. They weren't shamed for maybe having a different opinion, but instead they could make themselves vulnerable and enter into a conversation about things like marriage and why do you get married and what are the important things in your marriage that make your marriage special. All those unique conversations and starting points of that conversation were so critical to ensuring that Minnesota, like so many other states before us, didn't immediately develop two camps.
Right.
Those who are pro-gay and those who just weren't sure or were anti-gay. Because in the past, in all these other campaigns, those people in the middle, those people who really struggled over it, eventually heard things like, you're a bigot if you don't stand with me, or you believe in discrimination if you don't stand in me. But that never quite resonated, and so they started to shut down. And they really didn't want to pay attention to the conversation at all until the very end when they had to make a decision. And finally, when they're forced to make a decision, they're given two arguments. One, our side was saying, don't allow discrimination in the Constitution. If you do so, you're a bigot. The other side was saying, if you don't ban gay marriage today, your children as young as three or third grade will learn about it in school and you won't have any control. And so these people who, you know, inherently didn't want to participate in the conversation for the duration of the campaign, but now we're forced to make a decision just on the you know, eve of the election, had this frightening threat of, I'm going to lose control over what values my kids learn.
Right.
And so they reacted and they voted against us each and every time. In Minnesota, we took those learning that we got from Freedom to Marry, frankly,
a woman named Thalia Zavatos, who worked for Evan Wolfson at Freedom to Marry, had done an enormous amount of research, and she came to Minnesota. She was on the board of Minnesota United for All Families. And she helped us understand that our best position wouldn't be to react about this in anger and to try and use anger to fire up our crowd and to tap into that energy, but instead to build on the energy that was there from the people who are frustrated and actually allow Minnesota to have the most amazing transformational conversation that could take place over the course of 18 months.
Yeah.
And because we took a very deliberative approach of training people. Now, it was hard for me as a gay man to be told we need to talk about love and commitment, but I saw the data. I knew the data said that that was our path to victory. And so we set about making sure that every person who wanted to support same-sex marriage in Minnesota knew that the way to talk about it was one in which they created relationships and invited people into the conversation, and not one that simply shut the whole conversation down.
How do you approach balancing? I mean, given all of that, how do you approach balancing the personal and professional? You know, on the one hand, you're a gay man who is living his life. On the other hand, you're a campaign manager who is trying to build coalitions of support. Somewhere in the middle has to be, I would imagine, that balance between personal and professional.
Oh, it was. You know, one of the things that happened, so the legislature in May 20th, 2011, put this to the ballot, actually said, we're going to send this to the ballot. And that's what sparked this massive movement in Minnesota. And on May 6, 2011, so just 13 days before, so 14 days before, my partner of 7 years proposed to me. And so not only did I enter this thing as a gay man, but I entered this thing knowing that this very decision or this very outcome of the voters could prohibit something that was so special to me and my partner,
right,
to Justin and I. And I mean, there's part of it that knows, like, you're running a campaign that, you know, requires, you know, strict budget supervision and, you know, inspirational leadership and an ability to build a team that is ready to win. At the same time, you know that it's very, very personal. And the outcome is not only going to impact you, but it's going to impact everybody else. What I would say is that, you know, for me personally, that was a great motivator. It's a great motivator to really feel such a personal stake in the outcome. And at the same time, being a campaign operative and being a campaign manager, I knew my number one responsibility was to do everything I could to use the resources we had, time, our volunteers, and our financial resources, to stretch those resources as far as they possibly could go. And so, although I obviously had a lot of, you know, personal feelings about it, when it comes to stretching those resources, it was very easy for me to just hold myself accountable to making sure I was doing everything I could to leverage as many resources into this campaign and make them go as far as possible without allowing my own personal feelings to interrupt that commitment.
Yeah. We've talked so much over the past 7+ years on this show about trying to identify those various opportunities to build support. But I'm also interested in the other side of that. In your time there as the campaign manager, were there moments where you looked at certain either parts of the state or just certain populations and said, you know what, I just don't think we're going to be able to get traction there?
Oh, my goodness. I always, like, for example, take the Republican, you know, people who identify as Republican in Minnesota. I honestly looked at that population and I was like, this is going to be really, really hard. But not only in the ballot campaign where we faced we faced the voters on election day, but also in the legislative campaign. In each of those experiences, Republicans surprised me. I came into this campaign as a true blue Democrat. I had no interest in being friends with Republicans because I just, as a political operative, my job was to make sure that they didn't ever get elected to office. And I came out of my experience working in the marriage space with strong and deep relationships with people who identify strongly as Republicans. And I maintain those relationships today. I personally, as a professional and as a human being, learned something about myself and my own short-sightedness in years before working on this marriage issue, because I saw the power that Republicans have. Not only, you know, we didn't need to win a majority of Republicans. We knew that just, you know, numerically that was impossible to win a majority of Republicans. But we did know that if we got a sizable number of opinion leaders who identified as Republicans, that would help us get a critical mass of everyday voting Republicans. And if we demonstrated to people who identify as independent or in the middle or don't, that they don't have a political party, and they see all these well-respected Republican voices saying, yeah, we should have the Freedoms to Marry in Minnesota, that created space for those independents to say, well, boy, I can be with the Democrats, or I can be unsure. The Republicans are starting to tell me I can be in favor of same-sex marriage. And the only space in the Republican Party that tells me I shouldn't be in favor of same-sex marriage is if I look way over to Michelle Bachmann.
Right.
And Michelle Bachmann's over there screaming at me that same-sex marriage is the downfall of humanity. And those independent voters would look at it and say, well, on a whole, it's pretty clear that, you know, there's a critical mass of Republicans. There's obviously a lot of Democrats who support it. And I'm starting to hear from independents. And then all of a sudden you get to create this big space for people to say, you know what, maybe I'm wrong on this. Maybe I should reconsider. Maybe I should think about supporting same-sex marriage because I have the room to do so.
Right. The Supreme Court's decision had to have been, I'm going to use this word that I actually banned my students from using just for the sake of having a placeholder right this second. It had to have been interesting for everyone in Minnesota. Because on the one hand, of course, joy, joy, joy throughout the land. On the other hand, you guys are in this position that not a lot of states were in, where you were fighting tooth and nail to pass something that other states just weren't able to pass.
You know, you soaked my pride in Minnesota very early in this conversation. And what I would say to you is that, like many other states, Minnesotans always believe that we're a very special place.
Yeah.
And there are times when I hear Minnesotans make that claim, and I can intuitively understand that that's just pride in your state, and it's not necessarily unique from any other state or could be discerned from any other state. But on this marriage issue, I think Minnesotans do have rightfully a place to claim a special impact, which
yeah.
is to say, in 2012, the LGBT community and the marriage movement effort had never won at the ballot box ever on any type of issue related to marriage. We'd always lost, and especially when it was specifically marriage related to same-sex couples. And in 2012, to go from having zero losses to four wins, that was one thing. And for Minnesota to be the one state in the Midwest, the heartland of this country, to plant that flag and say, this country is going to go in the other direction, was very, very special. But not only that, it's to go from planting that flag on November 6, 2012, saying that this country is ready to go in a new direction, and then quite literally leading that country in that new direction within 6 months, and saying, not only can we defeat this bad thing in the heartland of this country, but you know what, we're going to proactively, through a political context, achieve the freedom to marry for same-sex couples. And that movement from November 2012 to May 2013, I think, does allow Minnesota to claim itself to be in a special place when it comes to demonstrating for the country that not only were we at a tipping point, or not only were we going to try and start going the other way, but we could go the other way immediately. And we didn't have to wait decades for state after state to eventually achieve the freedom to marry, but instead we could work as a country, as in our regional structure in the court system, to tick off large chunks of states. Because in Minnesota, if you can defeat it at the ballot box and win it politically, that creates space for other legislatures, like in Illinois, in Delaware, and it creates space in courts, like in the 10th Circuit and in the 7th Circuit, to really start pushing this issue in the other direction.
What I hear you saying is, so goes Minnesota, so goes the rest of the nation.
I think Minnesota, as a state in the heartland, in the Midwest, defeating it at the ballot box and then winning it through the legislative process is incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, I'm not purporting to say that, but for that happening, we wouldn't be here today. I know that so many people made this happen, but I do think that it demonstrated in a very powerful way what was possible.
Nice, nice. Well, tell our listening audience about United Strategies and what you're trying to do there.
Yeah, absolutely. United Strategies is a consulting firm that specializes in movement building capacity. So we like to work with nonprofit organizations to imagine how and where they want to grow their efforts to accomplish very specific goals within defined timelines, which I think is incredibly important. We specialize in development work, fundraising for nonprofits and for political candidates, ensuring that people have the financial resources to accomplish their goal. And then we also specialize in government relations, thinking strategically in a big way, how do we accomplish what we want at all levels of government, whether it be local, state, or federal levels. We have the ability to help folks put together a strategic plan that helps them engage policymakers in a way that will deliver the promised change that we know is needed.
Nice. And listeners, you guys can stroll on over to UnitedStrategiesLLC.com to learn more there. Give us some free consulting advice. What's that one thing that all of us who are doing this nonprofit work could perhaps be a little bit better at?
It's all about relationships. Yeah. Don't ever hesitate to take an extra 5 minutes to meet somebody new or to schedule a coffee with somebody. Those relationships will get your nonprofit organization much further than the next email asking for a contribution to the cause.
Nice. And how about some targeted advice for those of our listeners who are under 40, for those who are told time and time again? We get responses all the time of individuals who want to make a difference but are told, it's just not your time yet, you know, hang out and then you'll have the experience and the age to do more. What is your message to those listeners?
My message is never allow somebody to stand in the way of what you want to accomplish in life. I mean, I simply, after having that experience as an intern in college, realizing that I could impact people's lives in a positive way every day, that is what I've wanted to wake up doing every single day. And I've been fortunate, incredibly fortunate enough to be given opportunities to make an impact. And I every day, I can't wake up and get out of bed if I don't feel motivated to help somebody. And so I'm just so thankful that people have given me that opportunity. And I hope folks who are younger and are told that they don't have the experience to impact people's lives, we know that's inherently not true. Young people are doing amazing things each and every day, and nobody should allow themselves to be told no when we know that accomplishing great things doesn't require a certain age limit or minimum. You can just go do it.
Nice. Would you like to use this week's episode to announce your candidacy for anything?
I appreciate that. I'm going to hold off for now. I really do appreciate that, though.
Should we check in next week?
There's no pending announcements that I have approval from my husband to announce.
Okay. I want to remind everyone that this is the first installment of Richard Carlbaum Check 2016. We will check back every week to see if he's a candidate for something. I think it's coming, Richard. Do you see yourself holding public office again in the future pending some sort of spousal support?
I would never rule it out.
Okay.
Serving in public office is something that I truly cherish and I love, and I respect people who do, but I also feel like I have a great opportunity to impact people's lives right now, and if the opportunity presents itself, I certainly would consider it.
All right. There it is. We'll check back every single week. We'll see. Richard, what an absolute treat having you on the show. For folks who have not read about the work of Minnesotans United for All Families, and I would imagine you had the opportunity just to work with just amazing folks on that campaign.
Oh, my goodness. I am one person in thousands and thousands, 40,000 volunteers, but really, I mean, people who spent 80 hours a week working on this thing. I am just simply the person who got to lead the effort. There are so many people who deserve all the credit for this win. It's really amazing.
Well, my hope is that all of you know that while it had such an amazing impact on Minnesota, it was so inspiring for the rest of the country to see it and really gave us all new life of what was possible using all the structures that we have present and all that relationship and capacity building. So incredible work there. Listeners, again, stroll on over to UnitedStrategiesLLC.com to learn about what Richard is doing now. Richard, we are excited for great things as you have done before, as you will continue to do. Really inspiring work.
Well, thank you so much. Have a great day.
The wind chills my bones. I'm out here on my own. she's back in Minnesota. I flew in the sky, thousands of feet high, but to a place.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we are back with our second incredible guest for this week's show. Let me introduce her to you. Cindy Rizzo is the Evaluation and Strategy Senior Advisor for the Arcus Foundation, a leading global foundation dedicated to the idea that people can live in harmony with one another and the natural world. Cindy's worked in philanthropy for many years. She has a long history of involvement in the LGBT community. She currently serves on the board of Congregation Beit Simchat Torah. We've talked about them quite a bit over the years. And she is also currently the chair of the board of Funders for LGBTQ Issues. Past board membership has included Funders Concerned About AIDS, the Massachusetts Health Council, Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, Gay Community News, and the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. In 2009, Cindy was appointed to the New York City Commission for LGBTQ Runaway and Homeless Youth. And as if we thought, well, she's got no free time, apparently she's got a little, because Cindy's also quite the prolific writer. Her first novel, Exception to the Rule, won the 2014 Award for Best Debut Fiction from Golden Crown Literary Society. Her short story, The Miracle of Lights, was published in the anthology Unwrap These Presents. She has a ton of other writing credits that you should check out. And now she is here with us to help us make sense of some of this week's LGBT news. Cindy, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Cindy, I worry that you're not sleeping enough. You're doing a lot of different things.
Well, after creating change, I am pretty tired.
I bet. And we are going to talk all about creating change. Let's just start. Can we talk a little bit about philanthropy and your work in philanthropy?
Absolutely, sure.
What brings you to serve on different boards, Cindy?
Well, I care about the community. And when I'm excited about an organization or passionate about it, I want to do what I can to help.
Nice. And I assume that there is a Cindy Rizzo checklist for deciding if you're going to get involved with a certain board.
Well, some of the boards that you listed I was on because of my job, like the funders boards,
right,
and acting as Arcus's representative. And some, like Beit Simchat Torah, I am a member of that congregation, and we're having some really exciting things happen there, and I wanted to be part of that.
Such good stuff. We've talked about that congregation over the years. Talk about what it means to be part of such an affirming congregation.
Well, it's wonderful. I mean, we have great leadership in terms of our clergy and in terms of our board chair and staff. And it's just great seeing the diversity of the Jewish queer community represented in one synagogue. I mean, we have families with children, many, many of them. We have elder folks who have been part of the synagogue for many years, everyone in between. And we have an increasing number of straight allies who are part of the synagogue because they want a place that really cares about social justice and has a really prominent place in the community.
Oh, it's such good work being done there. Just give us that one patented Cindy Rizzo tip for philanthropy. What's the one thing that we could all do a little bit better?
I think we have to give to our own organizations in our community.
Yeah.
And look at those that may not benefit us directly, but benefit the most underrepresented or the most marginalized among us.
There it is. We have to support our own, don't we, Cindy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about one of those organizations. You just got back from Creating Change. I do not understand how I have never been to Creating Change. I keep trying to go. It's just something comes up. And because I'm a professor, it's difficult to get the time off to go. Why go to Creating Change? Let's start there. What it fuels your decision to go?
Well, I think people go to Creating Change for many, many reasons. For me, it's because it's part of my job at Arcus, and I have, you know, a lot of people I'm connected to from throughout the movement, both through my work and from before other activism that I do. And it's a great meeting place for people in the movement and to watch the movement, to watch a lot of young people, people who are sort of on the edge in terms of their gender expression and other kinds of things, and just to watch where the movement is and who's in it, in addition to the work that you can do to be there. And there's incredible resources in terms of training and networking and meeting people. You know, it's a very vibrant event, so I don't like to miss it at all.
Oh, I have to get there. I have to get there. Now, you wrote this lovely piece called We Can All Learn from Creating Change 2016. And in that piece, you actually say, you write, quote, "There's no point in me recounting the events or even my own experience that evening on the third floor of the Chicago Hilton. Can we just for 2 seconds, though, catch up our listeners? What would you say are the bullet points that people need to know before we have a conversation about what we can learn from creating change? So for folks who somehow were not in the know, how would you recount it?
The sort of series of events began before the conference. There was a reception listed in the program. Once the program was made public, that giant book that they put online and then give you hard copy when you get there, people saw that there was a reception scheduled by an organization called A Wider Bridge, which part of whose mission is to create ties between Israel and LGBTQ Jews. And they were bringing some folks from Jerusalem Open House, which is the LGBT community center in Jerusalem. People who have very strong feelings about Israel, about the occupation of Palestine, and feel that the situation of LGBT Israelis is as having better civil rights than those living in countries surrounding Israel is used as a way to promote the PR of Israel as a democracy, when in fact Palestinians are not well treated within Israel and within the occupied territories. So these folks who have sympathies with the Palestinians feel they call this pinkwashing. They feel that they use the LGBT issue as a way to detract from some of the more problematic issues. And when they saw that there was a group that was aligned with Israel on the program, they asked the task force to cancel the event. Initially, the task force agreed. The cancellation became very public. There was pushback from many quarters for many reasons, obviously people who support Israel, but also people who feel that creating change should stand for pluralism and should promote many different views instead of quashing one side of a debate. So the task force eventually agreed. The reception was put back on the program, and everybody went to the conference, I think, with a certain amount of tension about what would this mean, what would happen. And you could see from the program when you got there that there were many workshops and sessions scheduled on this issue of pinkwashing, and it felt like there was a lot of organizing going on, all culminating in the night of the event. There was a service held for Shabbat, which was on the program, and then a group that was sympathetic with the protesters held a second Shabbat service at the very same time. No services were disrupted. They both went on as planned. But it was when we got up to the place where the reception was held that everything sort of happened. There were many, many demonstrators, many people at this protest. I would say at least 200 people.
Wow.
The reception was held on a higher floor, meeting room floor on the third floor, instead of in the open areas around ballrooms, where 200 people in a long, narrow hallway was really sort of a recipe for disaster in terms of people's inability to get by them, people not being able to get into the reception, to get out of the reception. It was just a horrible situation. And what eventually happened is that some of the protesters came into the reception room and occupied the stage, and the program did not go forward.
Wow.
There were a lot of feelings, obviously, from that situation. But that's pretty much the facts of what happened.
Yeah, it's kind of become a little bit like Woodstock, where people are saying that they're there and other people were questioning, wait, were you really there? It's become quite a pivotal moment for the LGBT community at this point. But it happened, right? We can't unring the bell, and there was this experience that happened at Creating Change, and there's different ways that we can move forward. One of the ways that you, Cindy, have moved us forward is to pen a piece. What, before we get to the specifics of what you wrote, why sit down and write something?
Well, I came home filled with the incident, and having spent after that Friday night still in Chicago and there an extra day because of the storm in New York that prevented me from returning on Sunday when I was scheduled to, a lot of interaction, a lot of people talking to one another. I actually went to the conference feedback session, which is held every year, and it's usually pretty small. This year, apparently, from what I was told, it was the largest and the longest that had been held, and I don't know if that's because of what happened at Creating Change or that there were so many of us that couldn't get back to the East Coast. So I had a chance to listen to a lot of people, to talk with a lot of people, and it just filled me, and I kept thinking, what am I going to write about? I want to write about something, because I'm a writer. That's what I do. And this idea of looking at it as a series of lessons about how to move forward and learnings really struck me as probably the most constructive thing I could say.
And what did you learn on a personal level? What is it that we need to know that you walked away with?
Well, I talked about that at the end of the piece after I looked at what I thought each of the parties in the situation, the people sponsoring the reception, the task force, and the protest organizers, what I felt they could learn, the lessons. And then I felt like there was a lesson for myself, and it happened at that feedback session I mentioned a minute ago, where a young man that I worked with in the past, who actually I supervised for a little while, was there. I knew he, as an Arab American gay man, he was very involved in organizing his community. And I wasn't surprised to hear that he was one of the leaders of the protest and all of the anti-pinkwashing work that happened at Creating Change. I hadn't seen him up until that moment, which was the very last organized event of the conference, and he spoke. And when he spoke, he said pretty much what I expected him to say. Anyone in his position would say he was angry at the task force. He didn't think the reception should be held. But it was more that it was how he spoke, his voice. He was on the verge of crying. He was so overwhelmed by what had happened and felt so strongly and was so upset. You could tell he was in pain, and this is somebody I know and I've known for a while. And I just felt like all I wanted to do was hug him.
Yeah.
We didn't agree. I'm sure we didn't even talk about the issues. I went over to him as I was leaving, gave him a big hug, I kissed his cheek, and that's when my lesson hit me that the only way we're going to get through this stuff was through our shared humanity, through relationships, through trust of one another, even through the disagreements. And I just, on his part, assumed good intentions.
Yeah. Oh, it was so beautiful the way that you presented it to us.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it was really heartfelt. And maybe that was the moment where it led to me thinking, maybe I need to write about the lessons we all learn.
Right, right. And I would assume you are getting, because I've seen it, so it's an assumption based in fact, you are getting all sorts of responses to what you put out there.
I have, although I would say, you know, if I had to create a pie chart, most of the pie chart of my responses has been very positive and supportive.
Yeah.
And a lot of sharing of the piece on Facebook and other places. And I have gotten some critical response, some of which I thought about and was helpful, and some of which felt that I was, quote, blaming the victim because I held a wider bridge partially responsible for what happened. These are people that view them as having been wronged and really having no responsibility. So that's a difference of opinion and a difference of perspective. But I really tried to write about this in a way that wasn't through my ideological lens, that was really about looking at the situation that I witnessed completely from all sides.
Yeah.
And that's what the piece was about. It wasn't about how I feel about Israel, how I feel about Palestine, or any of that.
really was about how we connect with each other as humans, which is a key piece of all this, I think, Cindy.
I think so, and I try to make that clear and also not sort of reductive, not in a way that says, oh, come on, we're all human. That wasn't really what I was trying to get across. But I was trying to get across is that I know someone, I care about someone who doesn't agree with me. And I think it's through that kind of relational caring and trust that we move ourselves through these kinds of difficult times.
Yeah. Well, look, we are nothing but a positive show. We love highlighting positive voices. But we also, you know, have to be a little bit critical right now. It's kind of an interesting week this week, Cindy, talking about, you know, there's been a lot of feedback for the task force. There's been a lot of feedback for the Human Rights Campaign, who we talked about this a little bit last week, but it really blew up this week of their endorsement of Hillary Clinton and how they handled that. Mm-hmm. A lot of critical feedback that's just coming out this week about GLAAD. They just released their national awards and got rid of their blogger awards and some of the grassroots kinds of categories. It looks like right now, Cindy, there's definitely some work to be done to bridge the communication between individuals and our national organizations. Is that something that you're seeing as well?
I think that that's always true.
Yeah.
I think that the further away you are from local folks, the harder it is to bridge that gap. National organizations are somewhat removed from people, even though they have their constituencies, they have their donors, et cetera. Much easier when you're sort of a local group on the ground, like a community center or an organizing project. And these groups make choices, and they're not always going to be popular choices. And I'm not commenting on any of the choices particular, but it's kind of that phenomenon. That said, I think that, you know, our national groups could do a little bit better about feedback loops and about trying to anticipate what issues are going to be problematic for the community, and it may be explaining themselves better, vetting some of this stuff beforehand, just kind of best practices about this stuff instead of just announcing or doing something and then having to deal with the fallout from it.
Yeah. Absolutely great. Well, do a little Cindy self-promotion. Where can folks go to learn more about the great writing that you're doing?
Well, I have a blog on WordPress, which is Cindy Rizzo at WordPress.com. And I liked using Medium.com, which is a new platform that a lot of people are posting onto. So I might continue there. And then if anyone's interested in my fiction writing, just go on Amazon.com and type in the name Cindy Rizzo, and you'll get to my page with all my work there. And I'm very happy to hear from people, too.
Well, if folks have not checked it out, you must. Whether you were at Creating Change, whether you were not, this is what we do, folks. We take something that happens in our community and we use it as an opportunity to make it better, to make our community better, to make our relationships better. And that's what you've done, Cindy Rizzo, with your piece, We Can All Learn from Creating Change. We will certainly link to it on our site. Thanks so much for penning this, Cindy.
Thank you. I really appreciate the time today with you.
All right, folks, not a ton of time left on this week's episode. How could there be with two amazing guests? But still a few minutes to cover some of the LGBT news that's out there. We can flesh out a little bit what we were just talking about. So she certainly covered everything that's going on with the task force, and that is a huge topic of conversation right now at the top of a lot of LGBT news feeds, everything that happened at Creating Change, and a lot of frustration with how the task force both set up what happened, according to many folks, and certainly how the task force has been responding. So a ton of LGBT grassroots organizations have come together and they've written a letter to the task force saying this did not work out this was not ideal. This did not bring our community together. So that's the task force. As I mentioned in my chat with Kathy, then you have the Human Rights Campaign. And I barely know what to say anymore about the Human Rights Campaign, although I'll find something because I kind of want to talk about them for a few minutes. So as I was on the air last week recording this episode, that's when my piece in the Huffington Post came out about their endorsement of Hillary Clinton. And I called it disingenuous and unnecessary. So, you know, I can never seem to figure out what type of writing goes viral and what doesn't. This one, I didn't put as much thought into as some of my other pieces. And of course, I think the relationship is the less thought you put into it, the more chance it is that it's going to go viral. So that piece went all kinds of viral. And it was widely misunderstood also because it could have been better written, and I take responsibility for that. So basically what people were reading was, hey, this guy, Ken Schneck, this random professor guy in Cleveland with a radio show, thinks that the Human Rights Campaign should have endorsed Bernie Sanders, and that's the problem here. And no, that's not the problem. The problem is not with Hillary Clinton. The problem is not with Bernie Sanders. The problem that I was trying to pull back the curtain on is with the Human Rights Campaign. First of all, as Michelangelo Signorelli wrote a great piece questioning why the Human Rights Campaign had to make their endorsement so early. It's earlier than they've ever made an endorsement before, and his whole point was, why not hold off on your endorsement? Because historically, what we've seen in the past few elections is that the longer you hold your endorsement, the more the candidate courts the LGBT vote, and the more you can get out of them with regard to support for the LGBT community. So he did well to emphasize those points. My point was they just weren't transparent with the way that they went about this. The Human Rights Campaign has a metric by which they rate different candidates. Well, according to their own metric, Hillary Clinton has 89%, an 89% approval rating, and 89% support of the LGBT community. According to Human Rights Campaign's own metric, Bernie Sanders has 100%, right? So there's that. Then you have Chad Griffin, the executive director of the Human Rights Campaign, the president of the Human Rights Campaign. I'm not sure what they call him, president or executive director. I think it is indeed president. You have the part where he's got this past relationship with the Clintons, and he's worked for them, and he's fundraised for them, and there's that. And then you have the actual endorsement that seemed to be all about values, when in fact it sounds like it's more about viability. Here's the thing. All of those things are fine. You can make the argument that, yes, we're going to endorse Hillary Clinton because it's not just about that approval rating, because that approval rating is based on their time in the Senate, and Hillary Clinton has done a lot as Secretary of State. So that's how we explain away the approval rating. Yes, our president has worked with the Clintons before, but that gives him a unique perspective, and he's able to speak more to her candidacy than maybe some of the other candidates. Right? And then, yes, it is about viability. You can say all of those things. The problem is the Human Rights Campaign has said absolutely none of those things. They just issued their endorsement, and again, early, and Michelangelo Signorelli, check out his piece, because he did well in the Huffington Post to highlight there was no reason to go that early, but they did their endorsement and said none of these things. So here's the effect that it's having, and it's everybody seems to be talking about it. They were a 4 or 5 star rated organization on Facebook. At the time of this recording, they're down to 1.7 stars. There are close to 11,500 reviews, and something like 9,000 of them are 1 star reviews. People are getting more and more frustrated. Human Rights Campaign can't help but see that there is an outcry here, and their response, nothing. Their response is absolute silence. And so every time they post something new on their page about something else, people respond, yeah, we're still angry. Are you going to say something? And indeed, they are not saying a word. So you have all these grassroots organizations coming together and saying to the task force, you're not doing well at representing us. You have all of these individuals coming together and saying to the Human Rights Campaign, hey, you're not doing well to represent us. And as I mentioned very briefly, now we have GLAAD. So the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, they just announced this week their nominees for the 27th annual GLAAD Media Awards. Well, the outstanding blog category has been eliminated from all of their awards, and some folks are really upset about this, and this just came out. In particular, Mark S. King, who was on our show a few weeks ago, he wrote a great piece. It's called GLAAD Media Awards Dump Grassroots Voices. So this is what he wrote. The outstanding blog category has been eliminated from the newly announced GLAAD Media Awards, and along with it, the grassroots first-person voices of writers across the entire LGBT spectrum, including those of us living with HIV. I was honored to be a 2015 nominee in the outstanding blog category, and although I couldn't afford to attend, and he reminds us that the event is indeed a fundraiser, I truly appreciated the fact that GLAAD shined a spotlight on our work. Well, maybe we didn't sell enough seats to the dinner, despite multiple emails from GLAAD last year urging me to buy a table. Communications Director Seth Adams tells me that online journalism and blogging have become indistinguishable in the media landscape. That's ridiculous. Not only do we as bloggers provide a voice of the lived experience not featured in mainstream outlets, we are without the resources to compete with the likes of the New York Times, MSNBC, and other online journalism nominees. Folding blogs into the online journalism category is a disingenuous ploy. That word disingenuous just keeps coming up this week. Not a single past nominee or winner for Outstanding Blog is present anywhere on the 2016 list of award nominees. GLAAD hasn't simply marginalized the unique voice of bloggers. They have rendered us dispensable and ultimately invisible. It's shameful that a national organization that purports to lift up LGBT voices has dismissed the very people and outlets that deserve encouragement and recognition. But hey, won't the GLAAD award race between Carol and the Danish girl be a tight one? Maybe Eddie Redmayne will show up to the awards. That would be just the sort of evening GLAAD is hoping for. Again, that is from award-winning blogger Mark S. King, writer, HIV/AIDS advocate. He was on the show a few weeks ago, so you can stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com and click on guests and click on Mark S. King, and you can listen to that episode. But yeah, this seems to be the theme in every single one of these stories where they're national organizations, that they are out of touch with the individuals who have been supporting them, that they are out of touch with grassroots movements, that they are all about their black tie galas, and they are not about what's happening on the ground. It's really, really disappointing. Now, there is a big picture here, and I want us to focus on the big picture in all of these. The task force is certainly trying to do amazing good with their Creating Change conference. That is not a black tie event. That is individuals from across the country and certainly from across the globe getting together to talk about, hey, how do we make change? How do we bring these ideas back to our community? Incredible work there. Human Rights Campaign is trying to do some good on that national front. GLAAD is all about supporting positive voices in the media. And in fact, if we talk about the Human Rights Campaign for a second, there's a great piece over on theadvocate.com called Bernie Hillary, Oh, What's the Difference? And it's written by Amanda Carey. And Amanda Carey points out, look, if you are getting beat up in an alley, you would want either Hillary or Bernie to come help you. So I agree. We got to focus on the bigger picture. The bigger picture with the election, for many folks, is about defeating any Republican candidates who might roll back, and in fact, many of them have said, my first 100 days in office, I will indeed roll back LGBT protections. So that is the bigger picture. But in the meantime, this isn't about Bernie and Hillary. This isn't about which movies were actually nominated. This isn't about, you know, which sessions were denied at Creating Change. This is about the bigger picture of how do we hold our national organizations accountable? How can we say, hey, we need you to represent us? And how can we do it in a way that gets them to stand up and take notice? And so this is one of those points where we need to pause right now. That national LGBT landscape, there's a disconnect with what we on the ground are doing. So that's where I say to you, as I say to you every week, as I've said to you every week for 340 some odd weeks over the past 7 years, you have to use your voice. You have to use it in the way that you know that you have power to use it, whatever it is that you do best, to get these folks to pause for a second as you say through whatever means necessary, hey, listen to me. Listen to my voice. You gotta get out there and do it. Go lift up the voices of your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. Get out there, go make change, and please remember when you're out there using your voice, when you're out there making change, why be gay when you can be so gay?